He'd used the threat of Clarissa's sexual availability to manipulate Megan, and she'd let him manipulate her right out of his life, where she intended to remain. She went to the kitchen, looking for Verna Brickett. Chapter 13. When thirst troubled Kip, finding water to drink required little effort. Lake Tahoe was among the deepest and purest lakes in the world, and drinking from the streams that fed it involved no serious risks. The water was cool and clean. He paused in his drinking to watch tonsorial fish, their fins wimpling as they swam through the sun-pierced pools in which the descending stream periodically gathered itself. Hunger proved a greater problem. As a canine, he was a hunter by nature, but he'd never actually hunted, except when Dorothy had played hide the ball and he'd been tasked with finding it. He'd found the ball 1,000 times, but he'd never eaten it. The meadows were full of rabbits nibbling grass in the sun. When they spotted Kip, most of them either tensed and froze and pretended invisibility or raced away in terror. A few rabbits regarded him warily, then continued eating as though they perceived his weakness. Kip was physically strong, 70 pounds of muscle and bone. He was mentally strong, too. But emotionally, compassion remained at odds with instinct. Nature's way was for the sharp of teeth to feed on those whose teeth were blunt, for the strong to rule the weak. But he was a dog with the high-order intelligence of a human being, neither canine nor human. Intelligence gave rise to culture, culture to ethics. Although he was in the form of a dog, he was in spirit both a dog and a human being. This had been done to him before his birth. He had been as a child to Dorothy. His culture and ethics were hers, were human. Some human beings could kill their own kind in anger, for gain, and even just for the thrill of it. Neither Dorothy nor Kip were that decadent. Most human beings could kill in self-defense, and so could Kip, child of Dorothy. But rabbits were no threat to him. Neither were squirrels or field mice. He passed through meadows and woodlets alive with lunch and dinner, and his hunger grew. It would seem that, starving, he could kill anything blunt of teeth to save himself. After all, rabbits and squirrels were neither canine nor human. They were not his kind. Nature meant for him to have them as he needed. They were prey. This was where, in his present circumstances, the blessing of human-level intelligence became almost a curse. He knew compassion, mercy, pity. Those are burdensome qualities. Compassion, mercy, pity. At moments like this, smell became a philosophical issue. The sense of smell was central to a dog's life, as much as 20,000 times greater than that of a human being. His nose had 44 muscles, as compared to 4 in the human nose. His sense of smell alone brought him more information than all 5 human senses combined. In this case, too much information. Among the lower animals, every creature found joy in the fact of living. Kip could smell their abiding joy as pungently as he could detect the odor of their droppings, musk, breath, and warm blood. Compassion and mercy and pity versus the survival instinct. Human beings resolved the problem, sort of, by putting distance between themselves and the source of some of their life-sustaining fare by establishing slaughterhouses and the profession of butcher. Kip had no credit card to pay a butcher. This moment in which he found himself was called a crisis of conscience. His hunger grew. Being entirely in the form of a dog, and half a dog in spirit, he didn't drive forward relentlessly toward the boy whom he'd set out to find, or toward the satisfaction of his appetite. He was distracted by a dog's need to frolic. A small swarm of butterflies captured his imagination. He didn't try to bite them, but capered after those bright wonders, marveling at their effortless air dance. Perhaps a half mile later, a foil balloon, partly deflated but still buoyant with helium, floated over a field he was crossing. The word "happy" was clearly printed on it in red. He gave chase. The second line of letters, crinkled in and out of the deep creases in the material, seemed to spell "birthday." He had never seen such balloons before. Nevertheless, this one struck him as irresistibly strange because of its dislocation. The bright mirrored mylar drifting across this isolated meadow enchanted him. It seemed to mean something. Kip pursued it, leaping to bite at the long red ribbon that trailed from it. His teeth closed on empty air, and in frustration he leaped higher the next time, higher still. Just as he chastised himself for succumbing too completely to his inner puppy, the balloon proved to have meaning after all. He came upon a fluttering bird lying on bare ground. One wing was broken. In fright, the creature rolled its eyes and worked its beak without making a sound. Terror and pain robbed it of song. Nothing could be done for the bird. Its fate was to be taken by a hawk or a fox or something else and eaten alive. Kip considered it for a minute. He thought, "I'm sorry, little one." With one forepaw, he stepped on it, bore down with all his weight, and broke its neck. When humans went to a theater to see a tragedy, it was a play in which some great person fell from a height, destroyed by fate or a character flaw. Kip had watched comedies and tragedies on TV with Dorothy. A bird could have no character flaw. And yet birds, like all the little animals, had their roles in tragedies every day. In this beautiful but hard world, fate spared no species. This bird was plump. There was a satisfaction of flesh under the feathers. Kip turned away, leaving the bird untouched. He had no taste for tragedy. Less than a mile later, an aroma came to him that was familiar and delicious. Hamburgers on a grill. And not just hamburgers, also frankfurters. Drawn by the smells, he raced toward a wall of trees, through an evergreen woods, and out into a campground with a mix of tents and small motorhomes. People. Adults and children. He had 1,000 wiles and stratagems by which to charm them. He would be fed. In his hunger, he forgot for the moment that not all people were good. If even 100 of them were kind, there would be one whose every intention was wicked. Chapter 14 Shackett calls her from a motel parking lot on the outskirts of Truckee, California, north of Lake Tahoe, and he pours his heart out to her, confesses having made a mistake by not romancing her better back in the day, offers her the world in Costa Rica. And at first, she seems pleased that he's called. Judging by her tone, he thinks she regrets not letting him bang her, because if he, instead of backstabbing Jason, had knocked her up, there would be no Woody, no mentally disabled mute dragging her down day in and day out. He and Megan would have had a beautiful son, a good-looking and smart-as-hell kid they would have been proud of. So yes, at first he thinks she wants him. She needs him. He's got her. But then a superior tone comes into her voice, a snottiness he doesn't like, doesn't deserve, just can't tolerate. "I'm afraid you underestimate how a special needs child changes your life." Does she think he's stupid? How can he not know how some idiot mute would screw up her life? "I'm afraid our time has passed, Lee." As if she has 20 guys worth $100 million beating on her door. As if she ever gave him the time, which she never did. Their time never passed, because she never gave him the time. Never gave him the chance to pin her down and show her what she was missing. "What's best for me is what's best for Woody, and that's not Costa Rica." Can she really think he doesn't realize that she's shoveling shit at him? Hell, he can smell it over the phone. What she's really saying is that some pinhead kid who can't even talk is more interesting than Lee Shackett. That a dead-end life in a backwater like Pine Haven is preferable to white beaches and the blue Caribbean and the good life, if all of that comes with Lee Shackett. The angrier he gets with Megan, the hungrier he becomes. He's hungrier than he's ever been. Inhumanly hungry. 5 hours earlier, he stopped to eat in Bishop at this dump that some shit-for-brains critic rated 3 stars, and they couldn't even make a hamburger the way he wanted. He sends it back twice, trying to make them understand what rare means. The third time, it's still wrong, and the manager comes to the table, says, "Sir, what you seem to be asking for is steak tartare as a burger, but I'm sorry to say, we aren't a restaurant that's prepared to pull that off. There are health considerations with ground beef." Shackett wants to take his knife and fork, slit open the bastard, show him exactly what rare means. But instead he orders two more burgers, not 1 degree more well done than the medium-rare patty they've already served him. He eats all three burgers, but only one bun, and none of the fries. He pays, but he doesn't tip. On the way out, the waitress smiles at him and tells him to have a nice day, and he's reminded of his unbalanced mother, who refused the drugs prescribed for her condition, who could slap him hard enough to split his lip and pull his hair until he cried, and then, with apparent sincerity, claimed to love him more than life. In this moment, the waitress is mother, and Shackett has a score to settle with her. "Has anyone ever told you that you look like that actress Riley Keough?" he asks. This woman is 20-something, and shy enough to blush. "Oh, she's gorgeous. I'm not going to rush to a mirror and be disappointed." "Good for you," he says, "because fact is, that's a lie. You have a face like a shithouse rat, and any guy who ever humps you will want to commit suicide afterward." Her pleased expression collapses into hurt, into bewildered anger. "Have a nice day," he says as he walks away. He has long known that cruelty is a kind of power, but until recently he has not embraced it as a weapon in his arsenal. Now, hours later, he needs to eat again. There's a diner associated with the motor inn at which he's parked, but he doesn't want to go in there and get bad food, as he did at the other place. Besides, he's too angry at Megan. A snarky bitch. She thinks she's too good for him. Furious as he is, if he goes into the diner, he'll take his anger out on a waitress or on someone else, and the food will stink and there'll be a scene. He's got to remember that in spite of what his driver's license says, he's not really Nathan Palmer. He is Lee Shackett, the former CEO of Refine, and he's on the run from what happened at the facility in Springville, Utah. He has changed his appearance, yes, all right, but it's nonetheless a mistake to call attention to himself. He can eat something when he gets to Megan's place. She'll cook it the way he wants it. She'll do everything the way he wants it. He now sees what his mistake was all those years ago. He was too nice to her, too considerate of her feelings. Niceness and consideration get you nowhere with an ice queen bitch like Megan Grassley Bookman. He'll give her what she deserves, what she wants but doesn't know she wants, and when she's begging for more, he'll walk the hell out on her. Leave her in shitty Pine Haven and go to Costa Rica. It's maybe 90 miles to her place. He'll be there before nightfall. They'll have a reunion, talk about the old days, while he does to her what he didn't have the nerve to do back in the day. "I'm afraid our time has passed, Lee." "She'll learn different. He'll turn back the clock. It'll be their time again, all right." "I'm afraid you underestimate how a special needs child changes your life. He will show her what she really ought to be afraid of, the bitch. He'll also show her that her changed life can be changed again, for the better, just by slitting the little mute bastard's throat." He starts the engine and pilots the Dodge Demon out of the parking lot, onto I-80 heading west. In 24 miles, he will leave the interstate for State Route 20. For his entire life, he has been a target of injustice. Used and discarded, set up to take the fall for someone else, set up by everyone from Dorian Purcell to Jason Bookman to hot Megan Grassley. But he's not going to take it anymore. He feels a power growing in himself, a new Lee Shackett. He is becoming someone who cannot be denied, someone who doesn't need to play by any rules, someone who always gets what he wants, someone unlike the world has ever seen before, something special. Something. Chapter 15. Because she had not been merely a hired caregiver during the 18 months that Dorothy had battled cancer, because she had come to love Dorothy almost as if she'd been her daughter, Rosa Leon felt obliged to be present during the cremation. She waited hours at the mortuary and received the urn while it was still warm from the ashes that it held. She took that bronze reliquary back to the grand old house and placed it on the mantel in the living room. During the next month, as she'd been instructed, she would continue to live in the guest suite and organize a memorial service to be catered on the premises by Dorothy's favorite restaurant. "It must not be a solemn affair, Rosa. I want a celebration. Old friends gathered to share good memories, Laughter, not tears. Upbeat music. An open bar so they can raise a toast to me in my new life. In the absence of Dorothy, the lovely Victorian house, always a warm and cozy place in the past, felt cold and cavernous. Although Rosa had maintained professional composure throughout this sad day, as she stared at the urn on the mantel, she could not restrain her tears any longer. Dorothy Hummel had been the first experience of tenderness in Rosa's hard life. Hector Leon, her father, a house painter, had walked out on her and her mother Helen when Rosa was just 3. By 10,000 slights and insults, Helen had let her daughter know that she was unwanted, the product of rape and forced marriage, though there was ample evidence that the claim of rape was untrue, that her parents had once loved each other, if only briefly. When she was 16, Rosa located her father and paid him a visit, seeking only some small measure of the affection that any father owed his child. Hector had none for her. He said Helen had been the biggest mistake of his life, that Rosa was the mistake of a mistake, and he forbade her to return. Judging by the disrepair of the old bungalow in which Hector lived, considering the whiskey with a beer chaser standing on his breakfast table at 9 o'clock in the morning, he worked too little and drank too much. Perhaps not having him in Rosa's life might be a blessing, but at the time the rejection hurt. Throughout high school, she worked weekends in a restaurant, prepping vegetables for the cook and doing whatever scut work was assigned to her. She received a scholarship to nursing school, paid what it didn't cover out of her own savings, and found that she took pleasure in caring for those in ill health. She soon specialized in home care patients. She had friends, though none that were close, because she was always working. She had met no men who respected her, and one who so disrespected her that she had become wary of dating. Then at the age of 34, she had taken the job with Dorothy and found herself in the very lap of kindness, a caregiver cared for. Her patient was also her nurse. Dorothy saw Rosa as an injured bird who had fallen from the nest before she learned to fly. And if anyone had ever been born to teach a broken spirit how to soar again, that anyone was Dorothy Hummel. Rosa had never read for pleasure, and Dorothy seemed to have read everything. Then Dorothy insisted that Rosa read aloud to her, and month by month she found the truth of life in literature, the truth and hope in a new way of living. After residing in this house a year and a half, Rosa's heart grew stronger, and her sense of herself clarified. If Dorothy had lived another year and a half, but she had not. She was gone. Whatever healing Rosa still required was up to her to achieve. Blotting the tears from her eyes with a handkerchief, turning from the urn on the mantel, she thought, "I still have Kip to care for, and he'll look after me just as he did Dorothy. We'll heal each other, me and Kip." The dog was like a child to Dorothy. The bond between them went deeper than mere pet and owner, terms that Dorothy disliked. "I'm not his owner. I'm Kip's guardian, and he's my guardian." There was something mysterious about their relationship. Dorothy often hinted as much. In fact, she said that when she was gone and Kip became Rosa's to care for, there would be a revelation of some kind. "I might just haunt the place so that I can watch it happen." And where was Kip now? He could come and go by a special door, but he never left the property. He must be somewhere in the house. Ordinarily, he would have come running to greet her, a huge grin on that great golden face, his eyes shining with delight. He must have found a place to curl up and grieve. Moving from the living room to the hall to the dining room, she called for him, but when he didn't come at once, she stopped seeking him. She remembered how pitiable his whimpering sounded the previous night when Dorothy passed. He was a keenly sensitive boy. He knew Rosa was here, and when he was ready for company in his morning, he would come to her. Now she found herself in front of the study door, across the hall from the library. During the 18 months that she lived and worked in this splendid house, the study door was always locked. Mrs. Champlain, who came in to clean house 3 days a week, never set foot in the study. Dorothy dusted and swept that room herself until the last 6 weeks of her life, when she no longer had the energy for the job. "Of course I trust Mrs. Champlain and you entirely, Rosa dear, but that room is my most private place, where I keep all my deepest, darkest secrets. You may think I'm a foolish old lady who's lived a pampered life, with no secrets darker than having shoplifted a tube of lipstick when I was 16. But I assure you that I once had a wild side. And if you don't believe that's true, at least give me the courtesy of assuming there's a 1% chance I might not always have been as boring as I am now. Treat the study as if we're in a Daphne du Maurier novel, as if this house is an alternative universe version of Manderley, and I'm keeping either the murdered and mummified corpse of Rebecca or Mrs. Danvers, or both, behind that locked door to spare myself from a long prison sentence. From a pocket of her slacks, Rosa now withdrew the key to the study door. Dorothy had given it to her the previous afternoon, 10 hours before the crisis came, and instructed that it be used within a day of her passing. Rosa had not been told what she would find in the room, other than a computer on which were stored video files that she must watch. Although she knew there would be no dead bodies, mummified or otherwise, she hesitated. If indeed there were secrets in this room, and if they might alter her opinion of Dorothy, Rosa Leon didn't want to know them. In the lonely struggle that had been her life to date, she had met few people she admired, none more so than Dorothy. In the unlikely event there had been a dark side to Arthur Hummel's widow, some ugliness of spirit, that discovery would pierce Rosa hardly less than if an archer put an arrow through her breast. Yet she had promised to view the files on the computer and do what her heart told her was the right thing. A promise made must be a promise kept. Rosa unlocked the door and went into the study. The large room measured perhaps 26 feet by 30, with tall windows offering a view of the fabled lake through descending ranks of pines. To the right stood an antique Biedermeier desk that was large for furniture of that period. Behind the desk, a wall-length work area had been built to match the desk. On it waited a computer, printer, scanner, and other equipment. In the center of the room were a Biedermeier sofa and 2 Art Deco armchairs ordered around a large coffee table fashioned from a Chinese kang bed, on which stood an arrangement of antique Japanese bronze vases. Dorothy and Arthur had eclectic tastes, and a talent for making a variety of periods and styles work together. The most unusual thing was the alphabet painted on the wall to the left. 26 1-foot-tall black letters, stenciled on a white background, plus a series of punctuation marks. There were also symbols, at, and percentage, and plus, and equals, among them. On the floor in front of that wall stood a low contraption for which she could not discern a purpose. Rosa went around behind the desk and sat in the office chair and swiveled to face the computer. She switched it on. During the weeks that Dorothy lacked the strength to clean the study, a light dust settled on everything, but the system worked. Dorothy's password was Love Arthur. There was a separate file of videos. They were numbered. Rosa clicked on the first one, and when it began to roll, she was surprised to see a healthier Dorothy than the woman she had more recently been caring for. Dorothy appeared as she had been maybe 10 months or a year earlier, sitting behind her desk. Directly addressing the camera, she said, "Rosa Rachel Leon, you precious girl. I was fortunate to find you in my hour of need, and not merely because you've been giving me excellent care. I'm fortunate also because you're honest, ethical, and blessed with genuine sympathy, with humility in a world of pride and selfishness. Furthermore, you're far more intelligent than you believe." A blush warmed Rosa's face, as if she were receiving this praise in the company of the living woman, and tears formed again. She plucked a Kleenex from a box to blot away her blurred vision. "Within 48 hours of my death, Roger Austin will come to see you. As you know, he's my attorney. He will inform you that I have made you my sole heir." This was news to Rosa, and she found herself shaking her head as if this must be a dream, as if she must deny what Dorothy said in order to avoid bitter disappointment when she woke. "The law forbids a caregiver in a hospice situation to inherit from a patient. That's why, after 5 months in my employ, when I had come to know your heart, we changed your title to Executive Companion, and did so with such ironclad legal process that my will can't be undone. Anyway, I've no relative to contest it." Rosa found herself so nervous that she wanted to move, work off a sudden frantic energy. but she was so weak-kneed when she got up from the chair that her legs failed her. At once she sat down again. "After taxes," Dorothy continued, "you'll receive this house and all its contents plus liquid assets in the amount of $12 million.
"I don't deserve this," Rosa declared,
as if the woman on the screen could hear her and be persuaded.
"I was only with you for 18 months.
Dorothy had paused the video, as if she'd known Rosa would at this point talk back to her benefactor. Her smile was impish.
"How I wish I could be there to see you now, girl. I know you will feel overwhelmed, maybe even afraid at first. Fear not. Roger Austin and my accountant Sheila Goldman are good people. They will give you reliable investment advice. And in time, if I know you, and I do know you, you'll grow wise enough to handle it all yourself."
"Never," Rosa said, with a tremor in her voice.
"Yes, you will," Dorothy insisted with another smile. "And now to an even bigger surprise. Much bigger. Excuse a bit of crudity, child, but this one will knock you on your ass. Are you ready?"
"No."
Her arms on the desk, leaning forward, closer to the camera, Dorothy lowered her voice and spoke with a profound seriousness that mesmerized Rosa.
"You know Kip is a smart dog, but he's enormously smarter than you realize. He's a mystery, a wonder, and out there in the world are others like him. They call themselves the Mysterium. I can only assume he's the product of genetic engineering. Somewhere in his lineage must be laboratory dogs that were products of radical experiments and perhaps escaped. Dear Rosa, he is as intelligent as we are, and he is a treasure who must be protected. You must be his guardian now. After you see the videos that follow, after you watch dear Kip communicating with me using the alphabet on the study wall, you'll not only believe me, but you will, I'm sure, feel that you've found your life's calling."
Rosa swiveled in the chair to look at the foot-high black letters on the farther wall. Behind her, Dorothy said,
"Since I was just a little girl, which was a very long time ago, I've had this strange feeling down in the deepest and most secret place in my heart. I think you've had the same strange feeling, and just like me, you felt you'd be a fool to speak of it."
A pleasant chill crept the nape of Rosa's neck. She looked through the big windows at the descending forest, the lake beyond, the mystical scene in the waning light, the water like a mysterious lock in another land, where something lived that spawned a legend.
"All my life, Rosa, I felt that there's hidden magic in the world, that life is more than what our 5 senses can reveal to us. I've believed miracles really happen, and that one day a miracle would happen to me."
Even a girl raised in poverty and without love could entertain such a feeling. Perhaps it was especially true of a girl raised in poverty and without love, who had no hope other than what she spun from her imagination.
"Life crushes that secret feeling out of us if we let it," Dorothy continued. "But I never allowed it to crush that feeling in me, Rosa. And one day, the miracle came to me on 4 paws.
Chapter 16. He was a lucky dog. Children ran and jumped and capered throughout the campground. Little kids and older kids both enjoyed sneaking food to dogs. As further proof of his luck, he seemed to be the only dog here for the children to feed. Kids tossed balls and skimmed frisbees through the air, but nothing on 4 feet joined in the play. Not everyone had begun cooking yet, a little early for dinner. But at least 2 men stood ready at their portable barbecues. The scent of hot charcoal greased the air. One of the cooks was marinating steaks in a deep pan. He had just begun to light his charcoal. He was lean and deeply tanned, with his hair slicked back. On his t-shirt blazed the words, "Fork Off," under an image of a fork with 3 tines. 2 tines were bent down. Only the middle one was straight. This guy did not appear friendly. He smelled of envy and anger. The second man had thick hamburger patties sizzling on a gas griddle, and frankfurters swelling, sweating, charring on the grill. Kip took up a position where the action was, next to the grill master with the lesser meats. He sat, sweeping the ground with his tail,
pendant ears pricked as much as their nature allowed, head cocked, being cute. Kip had few peers at this, even if he did say so himself. Dogs were incapable of bragging, but they were also incapable of false modesty. Things are what they are, and that's that. The grill master was a person who talked to animals. He was no Dr. Doolittle, he couldn't hold a dialogue, but he seemed nice. He smelled of kindness, and he wasn't wearing a rude t-shirt. He called Kip Buddy. He said, "I had one like you when I was a kid." Instead of swishing his tail, Kip thumped it on the ground. "Are you lost, Buddy?" Kip stopped thumping his tail. Being lost made him more sympathetic, more likely to be fed. In fact, however, he wasn't lost. He knew where he was going. The murmuring boy on the wire drew him. If he whined and did movie dog shtick to suggest he was lost, that would be lying. Those in the Mysterium did not lie to human beings who smelled of kindness. This wasn't exactly a commandment, but it was a serious protocol. Deceiving people who smelled of anger or envy, or worse, was justified, because they were dangerous. Deceiving them could be a matter of survival. "Are you hungry, fella?" Kip thumped his tail against the ground, harder than before. Without being deceived by a whine, the man who smelled of kindness evidently decided that before him sat a lost and hungry dog. "I've got something for you." With tongs, he put a big, mostly cooked hamburger patty on a paper plate. He put a fat frankfurter beside it. "When these cool a bit, you can have them." Kip could whine now, because this was a whine of gratitude. The man stooped and examined Kip's collar and said, "No name, no phone number. Maybe you've been injected with a chip." Kip didn't have a chip, but the clasp of his collar contained a GPS and a small lithium battery to power it. Dorothy hadn't feared that he would run away, but she worried he might be dognapped. After flipping a few hamburger patties, the man cut into pieces the burger and frankfurter that he set aside for Kip to help the meat cool faster. A woman herded four children to a nearby picnic table. The two boys and two girls resembled her and the kind man. Their puppies. On the table were potato salad and potato chips and pasta salad and other things that smelled wonderful. The woman carried a platter of cooked patties and frankfurters to the table. The kids cheered and started building sandwiches. This was a happy place. The kind man put the paper plate on the ground, and the meat was cool enough, and Kip ate it with pleasure. He did not whine for more. That would have been ungrateful. Besides, the children at the table were digging into the feast. All he had to do was hang around. More food would be forthcoming. Indeed, he had to be careful not to accept too much and make himself sick. All of it was delicious. The moment was lovely, with the food and all, with everyone in this family smelling right, smelling safe, no anger or envy or other more bitter sense arising from them. Then the hater arrived behind Kip, who smelled him too late. The hater clipped a leash to Kip's collar and pulled it tight and said to the kind man, "Is this your dog? I suspect he's lost. We thought we'd take him home with us." "This is a dog-free campground," the hater declared. "He's not allowed. I'm taking him with me." He was wearing khaki pants and a khaki shirt, like a uniform. "When we leave day after tomorrow," the kind man said, "we'd be happy to take him with us." "He won't be here then," the hater said. He jerked hard on the leash to make Kip understand that he was in control, and he headed across the campground toward the office at the entrance. Kip went without a struggle. This was not a kind man. He might react to resistance with violence when they were out of sight. The stink of hatred was more intense and more frightening than any other smell, except for certain scents that identified different kinds of insane people. Sometimes a person smelled of hatred and insanity. This man reeked only of the former. Depending on what all he hated and how intensely he hated it, this might be a different man from whom to escape. Haters lived to hate, to exercise power over those they hated. They were obsessive about it, focused, relentless. The campground office was in a small log cabin at the end of the entry lane from the highway. Kip did not want to go in there. His collar was too tight for him to slip out of it. He would not bite except in the most extreme circumstances. That was a protocol of the Mysterium, and it was only right. Maybe there would be someone else in the office, someone who is not as wicked as this man. They climbed the steps and went inside. No one else was there. Only Kip and the hater. Chapter 17. The day synchronizes with Lee Shackett's mood, the sun fading behind gray shrouds as smooth as casket satin, the overcast slowly descending like a heavy lid. The late afternoon darkens into a long and sullen twilight. He leaves for I-80 with a two-lane state route that rises and falls over nature's wooded contours, cleaves flowering meadows, and for mile after mile offers isolated human habitats only here and there. Shadows gather among the trees in threatening convocations, and the late summer wildflowers, once bright, seem now to smolder in the fields, like fragments of some meteor superheated and shattered as it plummeted through Earth's atmosphere. Shackett's unrelenting hunger is not merely for food, but as well for justice, for transformation from the victim he's always been, for an undefined but amazing transcendence that he feels will be his. Pressure is building in him like superheated steam in a boiler, psychological pressure, but also what seems to be some kind of powerful escalation of his physical abilities. Hour by hour he feels stronger, his eyesight grows sharper, his hearing keener. What he feels has something to do with what happened at the refined facility in Springville, Utah. Engaged in longevity research, seeking to greatly extend the human lifespan, the richly financed experiments were, at the insistence of Dorian Purcell, focused intensely on archaea, the third domain of animal life. The first domain is eukaryotes, which includes human beings and all other higher organisms. The second domain is bacteria. Microscopic archaea, which lack a nucleus, were long thought to be a kind of bacteria. But they have unique properties, not least of which is the ability to effectuate horizontal gene transfer. Parents pass their genes vertically to their offspring. Archaea pass genetic material horizontally, from one species to another. Their mysterious role in the development of life on Earth is only beginning to be understood, and perhaps it is madness to seek to harness them for the purpose of improving the human genome and extending the human lifespan. On the other hand, although Shackett had first thought of the events at the Springville facility as catastrophic, he is beginning to wonder if the opposite is true. Although he has perhaps breathed in hundreds of billions, even trillions, of programmed archaea that are carrying longevity-fostering genes from many species, perhaps it is a mistake to regard the breach of the organism isolation labs as an existential crisis. One of the scientists in a position of high authority, or Dorian himself, evidently thought it was exactly that, and triggered the security program to lock down the complex and eventually burn it to the ground. Shackett alone escaped, violating protocols by not staying with the ship. To hell with the protocols. He's done the right thing for himself. Having fled Utah in a panic, he has had time to recover his composure, to reconsider what the consequences of the Springville meltdown might be. He feels free for the first time in his life. Free. He senses some awesome power growing in him, and a thrilling new confidence. In fact, leaving Utah, crossing Nevada, and now motoring west by northwest through the mountains of California, he feels as if he is leaving mere humanity behind. What if horizontal gene transfer via archaea is in the process of editing mortality out of his genome? What if the catastrophe at Springville was not a catastrophe at all, but a great, if accidental, success, with him as the only beneficiary? He feels a most satisfying contempt for everyone whom he once wanted to please. He's becoming, developing into someone superior, and he is excited by the prospect of proving it, of doing any damn thing he wants, with any damn one he wants, to anyone he wants, starting with Megan Bookman, the Ice Queen bitch who needs to be humbled. He will rule her. Or maybe he doesn't have to wait for Megan. In his becoming, perhaps he has already achieved the power to do what he wants, take what he wants. Ahead on this lonely state highway, a car is stopped on the wide right-hand shoulder. A man is changing the rear tire on the starboard side. A young woman stands watching him. She's wearing shorts and a halter top. She's a hottie. All of Shackett's life, there have been women he wants and can't have, women who respond to his overtures with disinterest or even scorn. This looks like one of those women. She looks like all of them. He slows and pulls off the pavement and stops his Dodge Demon behind the car. It's a black Shelby Super Snake, the quintessential high-performance car, possibly $125,000 off the showroom floor. He gets out, smiling, being the Good Samaritan.
You need some help with that?
Just a flat, says the man who is squatting by the rear tire well, using a lug wrench.
I almost got it changed.
Is this beauty a Shelby?
Super Snake. Last year's model,
the asshole proudly confirms. No traffic is in sight in either direction.
That's true power, sir. That's an epic vehicle. But you can't open her up proper on this back road. Not if you don't want to end up in the trees,
the Super Snake guy agrees.
But it's fun the way it handles the curves.
You like handling the curves, do you? Shackett asks. The asshole hears the sneer in Shackett's voice, and at once gets to his feet, the lug wrench in hand. Indicating the woman, Shackett says,
That bitch of yours sure isn't last year's model.
Something wrong with you? The Super Snake guy asks. He's tall, as solid as a linebacker, with the arms of a powerlifter. He's never backed down from anyone. He's the kind who's used to intimidating the hell out of other men with just a frown.
No, sir.
Nothing's wrong with me, Shackett says. Under the low sky, the day is still. No sound of oncoming traffic. He would hear engine noise perhaps half a minute or more before any vehicle came into sight. He smiles.
Nothing wrong with me that a fine piece of ass like her wouldn't cure.
Get in the car, Justine, the guy tells the bitch. He starts toward Shackett, his face as hard as a sledgehammer, confident in his size, holding the lug wrench as though he'll crack a skull with it. The woman doesn't move, as if paralyzed by fear. Or maybe she's excited, thinks nothing bad can happen here, gets off watching her man beat the crap out of people. Like an omen of perilous events, three ravens pass high above, issuing no flight calls, their wings slicing the airs with sharp silence. Everything means something important now. From under his sport coat, Shackett draws the Heckler & Koch Compact 38, which is loaded with hollow-point rounds, and he strides towards the linebacker, putting four bullets in him. Justine breaks her paralysis and screams. She's the Jamie Lee Curtis of her time, scream queen of the Sierra Nevada. She turns and runs, scissoring her long, smooth legs. Her strong man collapses, as dead as anyone ever gets, and he rolls down the embankment, limp as rags, all the muscle gone out of him, into the tall grass below. This is what it's all about. Being in command, being empowered, without fear, untouchable. Shackett is a changed man, a changing man, fast becoming someone new, something else. The woman is running down the middle of the highway, heading west, evidently hoping a car or truck will appear. Instead of sneakers or anything practical, the bitch is wearing sandals with a medium heel. She stumbles once, and then again. One sandal flies loose. She hobbles forward. Laughing at her frantic, feckless escape attempt, Shackett goes after her. A black feather floats in front of Shackett, a raven's shedding from on high. He snatches it out of the air, pockets it, a symbol of death bestowed on him as a sign of his new power, to assure him that he may decide who will live and who will die, and with what degree of suffering the condemned will perish. Everything seems like an omen now, means something important. He holsters the pistol, races after the woman, seizes her by her long hair. He yanks her off her feet. Justine tumbles to the pavement. Shackett punches her once, leaving her dazed and limp. He feels as strong as her dead boyfriend had looked. He scoops her off the blacktop as if she's weightless and carries her to the shoulder of the highway and drops her, kicks her, sends her rolling to the bottom of the slope. In a fever of desire and triumph, he descends to the woman where she struggles to get up from the tall grass. He falls upon her, pins her beneath him. Recovering from the punch, she struggles under him. But this contest is settled before it's begun. For she is the gazelle, and he the lion, she the fly, and he the spider. The sound of a truck engine arises, approaching on the highway above. No one can see them here in the grass, at least 20 feet below the roadbed. Although it's unlikely that anyone in the truck could hear Justine if she screamed, Shackett slams the heel of one hand under her chin and shoves hard, pushing her mouth shut, forcing her head back, her elegant neck arching, trapping her cry in her throat. Maybe the two cars, one behind the other on the shoulder of this lonely road, will seem curious to the driver of the truck. But with no one in either car, no one flagging passing traffic for help, there isn't any reason to stop and investigate. In fact, in this often lawless and dangerous age, a wise man would keep moving and avoid the risk of involvement. Judging by the sound of its engine, the truck seems to slow, and Justine apparently has a moment of renewed hope. She bucks and twists under Shackett, tries to force a scream through clenched teeth as he jams the heel of his right hand harder against the underside of her chin. Her taut and supple body squirming under him, her utter helplessness, his absolute power. Although neither of them is naked, this is the most erotic moment of Shackett's life, and he is rampant. Justine's hope is a false hope. The truck accelerates, and the sound recedes. She stops struggling, stops trying to scream. The quiet of the wilderness descends, deeper than before, without insect buzz or bird song, as if every creature that lives here is aware that among them has come one unique unto the world, one who is changed and changing still, one who lives by no rules, either of man or nature, who fears nothing, and who should be feared. He removes his hand from Justine's chin, hoping that she will scream for him alone, now that there's no one else to hear. She looks up into his face, her blue eyes wide, her nostrils flared, breathing hard, and says only, "Please." Shackett likes the sound of that. The word, the pitiable note of entreaty, the recognition that he is her absolute master. "Say it again."
"Please. Please don't hurt me."
He intends to rape her. Instead, to his surprise and hers, he bites. She screams. He bites again. And the biting is wonderful, exhilarating, the most fulfilling thing that he has ever done. Her terror is his ecstasy. Chapter 18. Woody in his room, at his computer, seeking justice. They said Woody's IQ was 186. His reading comprehension rate was 160 words per minute. Deduct 160 from 186, and you had the number of letters in the alphabet. He was born at 4 a.m., July 26th. July was the seventh month. 26 multiplied by 7 was 182. Add 4, representing the hour he was born, and you had his IQ. This was a Wednesday. Woody's dad died on a Wednesday. Exactly 164 weeks had passed since his dad died. Woody began working on The Son's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil, on the second anniversary of his father's death, 60 weeks earlier, when his hacking skills were refined to the point at which no security system, no digital defense, could stand against him. Deduct 60 from 164, and you had the number of pages that were in the document that would convict his father's killers. None of these numbers, from his IQ and reading comprehension rate to the amount of pages in the report, meant anything useful. They were mathematical coincidences, or perhaps they were patterns indicating a series of algorithms underlying the operation of the universe. But even in the latter case, they were so deeply woven into the matrix of reality that they were beyond human understanding. However, the way Woody's mind worked, his recognition of such coincidences or mysterious patterns was constant. This mental quirk, the recognition of obscure patterns, helped him pilot his way through all levels of the Internet, from the World Wide Web that everyone used, to the remote archives and the Deep Web, to the ominous byways of the Dark Web. To Woody, the Internet was a planet of its own. Every site a village or a city with its neighborhoods and streets, a planet across which he traveled as if by magic, typing a brief incantation, and with a click, teleporting from one continent to another. He had opened back doors in numerous computer systems and had implanted rootkits, which made it possible for him to return often and search their archives on such a deep and subtle level that even the best IT security types were unlikely to detect his presence. Just in case someone scoped him out as he was cruising through their data, he never went directly from Pinehaven to any back door, but spoofed his way through numerous domestic telecom exchanges and used other tricks, so anyone backtracking him would be flummoxed. In more than a year of intense effort, he had taken one known fact and Sherlocked his way to more than 100 pages of evidence that a special counsel, appointed by the Attorney General of the United States and given a platoon of investigators, might not have discovered in a decade. When you are a high-functioning autistic genius, your developmental disorder, coming with a singular ability to concentrate intensely for long periods of time on what might seem to be mundane facts, was an advantage of great value. The one fact he'd begun with was his dad's disillusionment with his boss, Dorian Purcell, the mega-billionaire. Woody overheard his mom and dad talking once about Purcell's messiah complex, and about Dad's desire to give his notice as soon as certain stock options had vested before, "I have to support ambitions of Dorian's that are just flat-out crazy." Once inside the computer system of Parable Inc., the parent company of Purcell's sprawling empire, Woody had found his way into Dorian's email and phone directories. They had provided him with a network of other people to learn about. Many of those hundreds of individuals were on one another's directories, a web of elites. But he had noticed that 16 of them shared a contact with an odd name that intrigued him. Gordius. When you're an autodidact who teaches himself to read at the age of 4, and when you're reading at a college level 3 years later, and when you're an inward-turned autistic who doesn't spend hours every day in social interaction or engaged in any of the pursuits that occupy most people, you have a great deal of time to fill. The most pleasant way to fill it is by studying and learning things. One of the things Woody had greatly enjoyed learning was classical mythology. In Greek mythology, Gordius was a peasant who became king of Phrygia. He tied an extremely complicated knot, the famous Gordian knot, that no one could untie. When Alexander learned that whoever solved the knot was destined to rule all of Asia, he simply sliced it with his sword. This man on 16 people's directories was named Alexander Gordius. To anyone lacking Woody's unique mind, the name would have looked like just another in a long list. But to him, it seemed unlikely that someone would be named for both the creator of the Gordian knot and the man who solved it with a sword. To him, it looked like a potential false identity. Woody had been curious enough to want to know more about this Mr. Gordius. Through a back door in the telecom company that carried the account, he initiated a search and discovered that the billing address for Alexander Gordius was a general partnership based in California, which was owned by a limited liability corporation in Delaware. And from there, the chase took numerous turns. He had needed a few days to discover that a bewildering variety of corporate entities, behind which Gordius hid, were all connected in one way or another with Refine Inc., whose parent company was Parable Inc. Eventually, he had squirreled through the back door of the Refine computer system. Once in there, he'd found and penetrated Alexander Gordius's email files and discovered that Gordius was actually Dorian Purcell. To the very exclusive 16 elites on his directory, Dorian wrote essays identifying serious problems facing humanity, and then proposing solutions, often controversial solutions. He covered everything from overpopulation to declining population, global warming to global cooling, nuclear fusion power to the practicality of million-acre solar farms, likely paths to curing cancer, and the possibility of drastically extending the human lifespan. Some of what Purcell wrote was intelligent, thoughtful, maybe even doable. However, much of it was as lame as it was pompous. He knew computers and solid-state technology, and much related to those fields, but he imagined himself to be an expert on everything. Although Woody had studied and learned a great deal, he was well aware that there were vast areas of knowledge about which he was ignorant, and probably always would be. There was only so much time. He knew what he didn't know. Dorian Purcell, on the other hand, seemed not to know what he didn't know. The Alexander Gordius email directory contained the 16 names Woody already had. but in addition, there were three very long email addresses that weren't names, that were nothing but series of random letters, numbers, and symbols. He understood that these must be sites on the dark web. The primary way to acquire one of these closely guarded addresses was from a like-minded individual. Maybe these were sources for drugs or for child pornography. Maybe they were online weapons dealers selling illegal stuff like machine guns and C4 explosives and shoulder-launched surface-to-air missiles. Woody had hesitated to check out these sites. He had thought about it for days. Eventually, he had chosen one with 46 characters in the address and had spoofed to it through the Alexander Gordius email account. He had been greeted by a black screen with one word in white block letters: tragedy. A series of quick clips from various TV news programs, both national and local, followed for 3 or 4 minutes. There were photographs of people who had died, video of crashed planes strewn across fields, and wrecked cars and burning buildings and racing emergency vehicles with flashing light bars on their roofs, of hospitals and somber police officials in front of microphones, and somber doctors in white coats at other microphones. With the images came snippets of audio, the voices of newsreaders, and of the grim-faced officials in the clips. Died in the flash fire following a violent gas leak explosion. Committed suicide by hanging himself from a barn rafter. Perished in a freak accident. Was killed by a hit-and-run driver. A senseless drive-by shooting, thought to have been committed by a member of one of the gangs that plagued the city. A murder-suicide that rocked this upscale community. Of a sudden massive stroke at the young age of 38. One of three dead in what police believe is a terrorist event, though no one has yet taken credit. When a photo of Jason Bookman flashed onto the screen, Woody had been so startled that he heard only the last few words of the audio. In the crash of a helicopter owned by the company. Then his dad's face was gone, and more tragedies were sighted until the sight greeting came to an end. The screen went black, and then three words appeared in white block letters. Enter your password. Of course, Woody hadn't been a user of whatever services were being offered, therefore he didn't have a password. He had exited the site. He sat staring at his blank computer screen for a long time, maybe an hour, maybe two, thinking. Eventually, with pen in hand and tablet ready, he had spoofed through the Alexander Gordius account and again entered the 46-character email address. Tragedy. The montages of images and audio began to play once more. As the newsreaders and others spoke of the deaths, Woody jotted down the names of the victims. He was prepared for the photo of his dad. As before, the still shot was followed by video of the smoldering helicopter. Jason Bookman, right hand to Parable founder Dorian Purcell and his pilot, died today in the crash of a helicopter owned by the company. At the end of this introduction, the screen again instructed, "Enter your password." Woody had exited the dark website, backed out of the computer system that included the Alexander Gordius email archives, raveled backwards through his spoof chain to quiet Pinehaven, this house, this room, and switched off his computer. That had been months earlier. Since then, he diligently researched the circumstances of the 41 deaths that had been referenced in the video introduction to the website. If any of the accidents seemed suspicious to the authorities, none had been reassessed as anything else. The suicides were confirmed as suicides by medical examiners in the various cities where they had occurred. None of the gang shootings and terrorist acts had resulted in the arrest of perpetrators. Certain subtle patterns in these events were apparent perhaps only to an obsessed, high-functioning autistic boy with an IQ of 186, but thousands of hours to devote to such an investigation. Of the 41 deaths reported, only two others seemed to have ties to Dorian Purcell, which meant nothing more than that Purcell wasn't the exclusive user of this dark web service. The site was not a statement about the fragility of life. It wasn't a memorial, an internet wailing wall against which to lament the role of tragedy in the human experience. Week by week, month by month, Woody had gathered compelling circumstantial evidence that tragedy was a murder-for-hire operation. He had been careful not to return to tragedy, for fear that they might have a way to detect repeated visits that did not result in the input of a password. He prowled through Dorian Purcell's email archives both under the billionaire's name and the Gordius identity, but he had not been able to ferret out any password related to the dark web site. Now it was a fateful Wednesday, exactly 164 weeks after Jason Bookman died, 60 weeks to the day since Woodrow Bookman began his investigation. 164 minus 60 equal the number of pages in The Sun's Revenge, faithfully compiled evidence of monstrous evil, though he hadn't crafted it to achieve that length. Mere coincidence. Or a consequence of mysterious algorithms by which the universe functioned. Woody planned to present the document to his mother in the morning. First, however, he intended to return to the dark web to confirm that the wicked site was still in operation and that its introductory video remained as it had been months earlier. As before, he spoofed through several telecom exchanges before invading the refined computer by the back door that he had long ago established. He used the Alexander Gordius email account to enter the 46 characters in the dark web address. Black screen, white letters. Tragedy. His vision blurred with tears when he saw his father's face. For the most part, he hid his grief from his mother. On those occasions when she caught him in his anguish, Woody smiled, or even laughed. She asked if they were happy tears, and he nodded, yes. When he saw her crying, her tears embarrassed him, because he knew they weren't happy tears, also because he felt he should do something to comfort her. But he was who he was, Woody the mess, and there wasn't anything he could do, so his embarrassment grew into mortification. He didn't want his tears to mortify his mother. The video ended, and the screen presented him with the command, "Enter your password." He stared at the three words, wondering how much you had to pay to have someone killed so that it looked like an accident or suicide or a terrorist attack. He didn't have any money. His mom bought him what he needed. He couldn't ask her to pay to have Dorian Purcell killed by a runaway truck or by a fall down a long flight of stairs. She might be sent to prison. She wouldn't like it there. Woody would be okay with going to prison himself. He didn't mind being alone in a small room, with nothing to do but read and think. But of course, they didn't send 11-year-old kids to the stir. Anyway, the murderers behind Tragedy probably wouldn't kill Purcell even for a gajillion dollars. As far as Woody could tell, this murder-for-hire website catered exclusively to evil people who really, really, really wanted good people to die. If it had been the other way around, if their business model had been to wait for good people to pay for evil people to be killed, they probably wouldn't have a lot of customers for their service. Good people didn't solve their problems that way, which was one reason why bad people got away with being bad for so long. He might have continued staring at "Enter your password" and brooding about good and evil, but a strange and disturbing thing happened. The three words vanished from the screen, and after a few seconds of blackness, two words in white letters appeared before him. "You again." Chapter 19. In the study of the house above the lake, through a series of videos, the late Dorothy Hummel chronicled her wonder-filled time with Kip. Rosa Leon, still in a pleasant state of shock occasioned by the news that she had inherited her employer's estate, watched one after the other with fascination. Speaking to the camera, Dorothy said that she had bought Kip from a breeder when he was 16 weeks old, a fast-growing ball of fur, full of spirit and curiosity. She'd had dogs before, all golden retrievers, and she knew how puppies usually were, so in just a few days she realized that Kip was different from others of his kind. She fed him two meals a day, one at 7 o'clock in the morning and one at 3:30 in the afternoon. By the third day in her company, Kip fell into the habit of coming to Dorothy 5 minutes before each feeding. He'd sit before her and gently, politely tap her foot with a forepaw. Dorothy said she'd previously had dogs with an intuitive sense of time, but little Kip took it one step further a week into their relationship. Dorothy was curled up in an armchair, engrossed in a novel, and Kip had no foot to tap. He wasn't a barker, so when she failed to notice his impatient pacing, he went into the kitchen, leaped onto a chair, retrieved her wristwatch, which she'd taken off and left on the table, brought it to her in his mouth, and dropped it on her lap. When Dorothy realized it was feeding time, Kip's act stunned her. She got up from the armchair and stood looking at him, and he returned her stare as if to say, "What do you think about that?" She had always talked to dogs as if they understood her, and she didn't feel the least bit foolish when she asked him if he knew the purpose of a watch. In answer, he went to the archway between the living room and the downstairs hall, and she followed him as he led her to the grandfather clock in the entrance foyer. Wristwatch and clock. He turned and padded along the hallway to the kitchen, with Dorothy close behind. She found him standing past the pantry door, gazing up at the wall clock. Snatching her iPhone from the table, she had made a video that she later imported to her computer, and that now replayed for Rosa. Dorothy asked Kip to identify the refrigerator, and he went to it. She asked him to go to the sink, and he did. She asked him to go to the cooktop, to the back door, to the trash compactor, to the hall door, to the laundry room door, which he did, tail wagging the whole time. The next day, Dorothy had bought a video camera. As if he had second thoughts about revealing his extraordinary nature, Kip refused to repeat his performance. He reacted to her entreaties with yawns and puzzled expressions, wandered away, found his nearest bed, and took a nap. Over the next couple of weeks, however, Kip discovered he was a dog who loved stories. He was unable to play dumb dog any longer. Chapter 20. You again. As Woody considered those ominous words, his mouth flooded with saliva, as if maybe he was going to throw up. His heart pounded, and he felt as if the O in you was an eye that stared at him without blinking. They couldn't be looking at him. For one thing, he had a piece of painter's tape over the camera in his computer. Besides, he had spoofed them through multiple exchanges, and there was no way that they could track him to source in the short amount of time that he had been on their site today. The two words blinked off the screen, and letters appeared from left to right, as if someone was texting him. Y-O-U-A-R-E-N-O-T. Woody watched with growing horror as the message completed. You are not Alexander Gordius. They couldn't know all the exchanges through which he'd jumped to get there. Couldn't know his origin, not this fast. But they knew whose account he had hijacked to visit them. Those words blinked off the screen, and four more appeared letter by letter. We will find you. He bailed out of the site, dropped off the internet, switched off his computer. He wheeled his chair backward, crawled into the knee space of his workstation, and pulled the computer plugs, though that precaution seemed both unnecessary and pointless. The security program at Tragedy evidently monitored the origin of each visitor to the site, and if someone visited but had no password to enter, the program apparently issued an alert to the effect that they might be the target of a phishing expedition by someone not on their client list. He had gone to the site twice before. Although months had passed between those contacts and his third visit today, their security system had been lying in wait for him. Okay. All right. Stay cool. No reason to sweat it. No problemo. Zip. Zero. Nada. In such a short time, they can't possibly have tracked him to source through a series of 9 exchanges. Anyway, he'd used a few other deceptions to cover his trail, and he would never, never, never go back there. Sweat broke out on his brow, and nausea rolled through him. He needed something to settle his stomach. A Coca-Cola. That was all he needed, a Coca-Cola. And then he'd feel all right. Chapter 21. Kip in the Kingdom of the Hater. Stitched on the pocket of the man's khaki uniform shirt was the name Frank. He had a black mustache and eyebrows almost thick enough to be 2 more mustaches. His eyes were hard little green marbles. Frank smelled not only of hatred, but also of garlic, verbena aftershave, coconut-scented hand sanitizer, antiperspirant, and chapstick, among other things. His work shoes exuded the odor of fresh human urine, suggesting that when he had most recently peed, he had not at first aimed well. In addition to a metal desk and 2 visitor chairs and an office chair and file cabinets, the front room of the cabin contained a grizzly bear. The life-size sculpture had been carved out of a log. The 7-foot-tall bear stood on its hind feet, arms reaching, teeth bared. The Bruin looked so fierce that Kip whimpered even though he knew it wasn't real. Evidently out of concern that the grizzly would topple over in a quake and crush someone, two steel rods extruded from its back and were bolted to the wall. Frank the Hater tied Kip's leash to one of those rods. Pretending meek submission, Kip settled at the feet of the bear and sighed as if with resignation. In fact, he was waiting patiently for an opportunity to escape. Dogs were the most patient creatures on the planet. They passed their lives waiting for their humans to walk them, play with them, cuddle them. No matter how attentive their people were, dogs spent more time waiting than doing. Which was okay. Humans were busy, with more responsibilities than dogs would ever have. Most dogs. Frank the Hater went around behind his desk and sat in his chair and plucked the handset from his phone. He keyed in a number. When someone answered, the Hater said,
"I have us a good one, Fred. He's a golden. Maybe from pure stock. Looks like a show dog."
After a listening pause, Frank continued,
"Didn't have to nab him from anyone. He's a stray."
"I'm not a stray," Kip thought. "I'm an orphan on a mission."
"If we breed him to every golden bitch we can find," Frank said, "it'll be like printing money."
Fred said something, and Frank replied,
"He's the docile kind. He'll take to a cage and do what he's told. See you in an hour."
After he hung up, the Hater looked across his desk at Kip. Now he also smelled of greed.
"My brother's gonna breed you till you drop, young fella. There's worse ways to spend a life."
They were puppy mill operators. The breeder dogs in those operations lived their entire lives in small cages, poorly fed, rarely if ever exercised, no medical care, never bathed, their coats matted, bodies riddled with ticks. Puppy mill dogs lived in despair. They never knew affection or play, only cruelty. Kip gave no indication of alarm. He yawned and sighed and closed his eyes as though to take a nap. Maybe the time was coming when the protocols of the Mysterium would allow him to bite Frank the Hater. Chapter 22 Rosa Leon needed a drink. She didn't use alcohol often, just an ice-cold bottle of Corona now and then. Becoming a millionaire and the caretaker of a super-intelligent dog, both in one day, called for something stronger than beer. Dorothy had liked a cocktail or two in the evening. Her study included an under-the-counter refrigerator and an ice maker. The refrigerator contained, among other things, lemon-flavored vodka. Rosa found a glass, put some ice in it, and poured a double shot. She returned to the office chair and the computer, and the amazing videos. After the day of the watch and the clocks, almost 2 weeks passed while Kip had played dumb puppy. He was concerned that he should not have revealed his true nature so soon after coming to live with Dorothy. Or perhaps ever. Those in the Mysterium had different views about to whom and when the truth of them should be revealed. Their protocols forbade making such revelations to anyone who smelled of hatred. They were to take into their confidence only those who smelled of kindness and love, who had about them no scent of envy or greed. Dorothy was certainly a person of righteous qualities, but young Kip had been impetuous when he did the trick with the watch and all that followed. In the experience of the Mysterium, people needed to be carefully prepared for this revelation. They handled it better if they first had slowly come to suspect they were dealing with a dog who was more than a dog. Kip's love of stories made it impossible for him to keep his great secret for years, or even months. Dorothy had been a lifelong heavy reader, as had been her husband Arthur. Books were a key decor item in their house, rooms shaped around shelves. When she cooked or worked one of the large jigsaw puzzles she enjoyed, she didn't listen to music, but instead to audiobooks. The dog could not conceal that the narrator's voice enthralled him. Whether he sat or stretched out in one position or another, his eyes remained on the MP3 player. He never napped when a book was playing. Dorothy watched him surreptitiously and saw how reliably startled he was by unexpected twists in the story, and how certain emotional scenes caused him to pant or whimper or chuff in ways quite appropriate to the circumstances of the characters. As Dorothy had spent a December morning and afternoon in the kitchen, baking for the coming holiday, the audiobook they listened to was A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens. in the chapter titled The Last of the Spirits, when the ghost of Christmas Yet to Come conveyed Scrooge into the Cratchit house on the day of Tiny Tim's death, Kip retreated to the farther end of the kitchen and sat facing into the corner. His head hung low. Dorothy watched him for a moment, and then paused the audio to ask if he was sad. Kip turned his head to look at her over his shoulder, and he issued a sorrowful whimper. Now, as Rosa watched the video of Dorothy recounting all this, she realized that she had become as enchanted with her benefactor's story as Kip had been with A Christmas Carol, and she wondered why she had no doubt whatsoever that it was true. Well, for one thing, Dorothy had been neither delusional nor a liar. And in retrospect, Rosa saw that in her own interactions with Kip, there had been moments where he had charmed her with behavior that seemed unlike that of an average dog. On other occasions, he had been so quick-witted that he briefly